was a killing that shocked the United States and the world.
Lee. I think we are there.
400 years of black people having to come to terms with these kinds of vicious murders and assassinations and attacks.
But the response was simply extraordinary. The biggest uprising America has seen for many generations, possibly since the great civil rights movement itself.
No justice! No peace!
We've been fired at with rubber bullets. My cameraman has been hit.
When I saw the video of George Floyd getting murdered in cold blood, I've never felt anything like that in my life, man.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper. In today's show, we are talking about racism, state racism, its violence and its histories. We want to uncover the hope in this moment of great tragedy and suffering, at this pivot point in history where transformative change and terrible reaction both seem equally possible, indeed plausible. We ask, how can we win that positive change that we need? We also want to reflect on Europe's place in this troubling moment. As European politicians and businesses fall over themselves to declare that Black Lives Matter, we will politely point out that this isn't good enough. Fine words are important, but not enough. The bitter truth is that black lives often don't matter in Europe too, as we've seen on the Mediterranean and Aegean Seas across the last decade. Joining us to find answers is Dindi Katonga, a Black Lives Matter activist based in Los Angeles. Quincy Gario, a performance artist and activist in the movement against Zwarte Piet from Amsterdam, Netherlands. And Shyster Aziz, a Labour councillor in Oxford, involved in the Roads Must Fall campaign. As usual, you can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org. You can also support the podcast by leaving a rating or review on your podcast platform. To join and support our work, go to anothereurope.org/join. It's not expensive at all and helps us to keep getting these ideas and campaigns out to lots and lots of people.
No justice, no peace! No racist police! No justice, no peace! No racist police! No justice, no peace! No racist
That's a photographer.
What's going on now?
A member of the press.
Now there's just a lot of violence erupting.
Dindi, it's been 3 weeks now since George Floyd was killed. Can you lay out for us the social movement that has erupted in the United States in response? I mean, we're all, of course, looking at this from afar. It does feel like it's been a turning point for America and American politics in quite a profound way.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I always want to begin by always uplifting the victims of police terror and police brutality and state violence here in the United States and everywhere in the world. And just reminding everyone that we do this work in their honor because we're compelled to and because it is a matter of justice and very important for humanity. So the past 3 weeks have been quite interesting, quite challenging, but also inspiring. And so we started out with large protests and a huge backlash from police, a lot of brutality brought down on protesters, a lot of arrests, which are really disturbing to us since we're still in a pandemic and we were having spikes, and also quite concerning to us because African Americans, Black people, and Brown people, Latinx folks in this country have been very much affected by this pandemic. So there have been those. There's been a tearing down of statues, Daughters of Confederacy. This week it's been Christopher Columbus going down. Super exciting and quite glorious to see the masses just rejecting these figures, these kind of vestiges of empire and colonialism and racism and all of these other things that we're rejecting. We did have curfews about a week ago. We no longer have curfews. And quite frankly, it's not because the state is polite or generous. It is because many of us resisted and rejected being occupied in the streets. We claimed it was our right to be there. And we pushed back and we showed up at city council meetings and all of these types of things. And so they peeled away curfews. but you still have massive protests. This past Saturday, after we talked, I was in one with, I think, 100,000 people. Just every day, people resisting. There are no signs that this is going away. But beyond the protests, which get the most attention, we have some material wins. So here in Los Angeles, we have seen police start to de-escalate somewhat. We've also seen cuts to the LAPD budget. We've seen our mayor and public officials at least be forced to address these problems. And you can see that they're nervous. They're cracks, and you can see that they need to be accountable to people now. So that's where some of these differences lie.
The LAPD has this fearsome, like, horrible reputation, and rightly so, for many, many years, right? And you get a similar phenomenon, I think you said, mentioned when you were talking to Another Europe before, in Minneapolis as well, in the sense that it's a police force with a really nasty history and reputation, but in both places, very progressive cities, very radical cities. So could you tell us a little bit about that? I'm really, that must be a big part of the conflict now underway.
It really is, because here in Los Angeles, places like San Francisco, Minneapolis, Chicago are known for progressive values and progressive politics. And we've elected people who've, quite frankly, have been media darlings for a long time. But they uphold white supremacy. They uphold all of these systems that we reject. And I think for a long time, especially after 2016, a lot of these politicians have been able to sit easy, because as long as you were anti-Trump, as long as you weren't into that, you know, people really gave you a pass. But the liberal order, like I keep saying, is really struggling with what to do. We are seeing them symbolically show up and kneel and protest with us, but their politics are still quite toothless, because we are demanding that they defund the police. We are demanding they get police out of schools. We are demanding that they disarm the police. And because they don't think they're beholden to us as a people, they've not had to do a whole lot. So that's been an interesting shift. Really, regular, ordinary people who live in progressive cities recognizing that these are not radical politics at all. They're progressive politics. You have reformers who, you know, tweak things at the margins, but they don't serve their communities.
What's amazing about the protests is that it reminds me of this long trajectory of protests that we've seen the last, what, decade? Since Occupy Wall Street, and then the Standing Rock in 2016, the protests in 2014, Trayvon Martin 2012. So it's like this building up of this final moment, like, you know what, it's done. And we've been asking nicely, we've been sold the lie that, you know, civil rights legislation supposedly leads towards us being accepted as fully in the society, and that's just not the case. Reagan, Bush Jr., all of them kept on enacting the same type of racist policies that people were fighting against in the 1950s and 60s. So it's like, okay, let's go for it. And it does feel like a turning point when looking at it from the outside, because it's now not just a question of the photo ops, like the 94 crime bill, where you can see all of these supposed leaders of the black community standing behind politicians feeding the carceral system. But you can actually see actual material gains being made, like the defunding of the LA budget, the police budget. I'm like, wow, that's some good stuff. Or in Minneapolis, the defunding of the police, and actually thinking, like, how can we think about taking care of each other and justice and restorative justice in a way that doesn't lead to private prisons being filled up with black and brown bodies. And I'm like, okay, this is what we need. So this is amazing looking from the outside in, and also in the way how it inspires and keeps the rest of us also on our toes to, like, call the ambassadors and the diplomats here on their nonsense. Like, hey, you want to help us here with our issues, but what about back home? And what are you doing as a cog of this system trying to present itself as positive for positive change around the world that does not reflect the positive change that you want within your own country? Like, how can you export democracy if democracy is broken, if that's the type of democracy that you want to see in the rest of the world. Every time something like this happens, you are also ashamed in a certain sense that we need, or that the system, or that the dominant community and the dominant groups need footage of trauma to get them to move. And I'm like, if someone tells you this is happening, why do you have to see someone dying for you to stand up and do something? This is something that's been said for so long, and you need to see another black body on your phone, on your TV, on your laptop, on your screen. Like, why? Why do you need black death to put you on the street? No. Me telling you should be enough. You looking around and being in a completely white-dominated space should tell you that something's wrong.
Yeah, I fully agree with all of that. I think, you know, what's been going on over the past 3 weeks is incredible. The ripples are absolutely being felt everywhere around the world. I'm here in Oxford, as everyone can see through the footage this week. There's been a massive protest against Cecil Rhodes' statue, which has been hovering over our high street for hundreds of years. And what we're seeing through the Black Lives Movement in the United States and the horrific murder of George Floyd is we're seeing the people of our city, the working class, multiracial people of our city, coming into the centre of the city, which does not belong to us. It belongs to the institution that is the University of Oxford, or so they think it belongs to them, right? There's a massive class and race divide in this city, which is really, really entrenched. And as someone born and raised here, I've known about this and I've felt it my whole life. But on Tuesday, the protest was extraordinary because the people of the city took to the centre of the city. And we made it extremely clear that this statue, this glorification of a proud British imperialist, will not be hovering over us anymore. And also, I think what that protest also did was, I know you've been talking about this, but the multiracial elements of this movement. We've not seen that before in this country. This is the beginnings of an anti-racism movement that, rightly so, is being led and formed by black people, which hasn't happened before, horrifically, okay? And it's being backed up by people of colour, it's being backed up by white working class people, a whole range of people coming together who are starting to really question what is going on in this country. And I think it's really exciting. We're just scratching the surface. There's so much work that needs to be done. And I think one of the things now that I'm really mindful of, so you have to make sure that this movement remains as diverse as it is. And we have to be really mindful that the co-option doesn't start gaining traction. And as we know, throughout history, the movement has collapsed from within. It's not from outside, okay? And, you know, who gets to lead a movement, who gets to speak for a movement, who gets to create a movement is all part of white supremacy's functions. And I'm seeing it in the city. I'm seeing it really clearly in the last sort of 72 hours, the desires of certain individuals to claim this narrative, to claim this movement. And it's like, well, you can't claim this movement because it doesn't belong to you. And I think also the way power, the way white supremacist structures of power are reacting to this is sadly as predictable as you'd always expect it to be. But the thing is, because the world is on fire, right, their responses are just they look even more absurd and out of touch than they ever have. And even their own people who support them, members of the establishment, are turning around and saying, what are you doing here? You're gonna have to up your game. So I think that's really exciting as well.
And we'll come back to the global side in just a moment, but for now we'll just stay on the US for a bit longer and talk about our not favorite person, Donald Trump. I mean, clearly his reaction to these protests, I mean, there's been so many lows. Like, I can't imagine what it's like to live in the US through this. Indeed, certainly as a person of color through his presidency, I mean, that is a terrifying thing in itself. There have been so many lows, but nonetheless, his statement from the White House steps was truly harrowing and fascistic in its language. Not a word that I would use lightly, and not the first time that Donald Trump has used fascistic language either, threatening to invoke the Insurrection Act, threatening essentially to mobilize the federal army to crush the protest movement.
If a city or a state refuses to take the actions that are necessary to defend the life and property of their residents, then I will deploy the United States military and quickly solve the problem for them.
His rhetoric was full of coded references to violence.
These are not acts of peaceful protest. These are acts of domestic terror.
Where does this leave his presidency? Because even if the kind of politics that he represents might be, we hope, losing enough support to lose the presidential elections, there does seem to be, I don't know if you agree, quite a large support base for, if you like, core Trumpian politics in the United States. Quite a large number of people that no matter what happens with the presidential election, they're still going to be there. And you saw that most clearly with these protests against the lockdown, right? Armed white supremacists on the streets of the United States. Really scary.
Yes. Yes. And I will completely agree with you on this. There is no bottom with Donald Trump. There's truly no bottom. That I continue to be shocked might be my fault at this stage. This language, I agree with you, is authoritarian. It is kind of fascist speak. It's very harmful and it's traumatizing. And he still has support. He has significant support from people who are hanging on to kind of this white supremacist and also settler colonialist conversation. This, you know, we are here and the rest of you are invaders. You know, we are here and we're holding on. But these are truly the death throes of a dying institution. We might not be able to get it right in November. And if we don't, it's because the Democrats, the so-called other side of the coin, do not have politics that go beyond we are not this other guy. And we are quite nervous that Trump will, in fact, be able to come back in November. We are also questioning not just the language, but also the violence, the state violence that I witnessed in D.C. when you deploy the military against your own human population and your own citizens is really quite disturbing. So much so that this individual who has had support or at least some kind of acceptance from the military, we've seen them write a letter and quite a few people resign, really resisting this idea that you should take over streets and brutalize people and threaten them. We're also really questioning the idea that protesters, we get to be thugs, we get to be all Antifa, which we're fine with because we are anti-fascists. We get to be invaders, we get to be an infestation, we get to be the unruly, unwashed hoi polloi in the masses. And other people get to be respectable. You can tote your gun and not be harmed by police. And we're also really becoming aware and educating everybody about kind of this intersection of law enforcement, police, military, and white supremacy. So here in Los Angeles, for example, we've had quite a few, the whole thing, I consider it to be a gang at this point, but quite a few of those members being active members in the KKK, being in actual white supremacist movements. So there's that connection that we're seeing, and we are rejecting it. And I think what's a little bit different about protesting here in the U.S. is every time you actually go out there and you face the rubber bullets and being tased and the pepper spray and all of this is we have a really heavily militarized police force. So all of the tools of empire that are used against brown bodies and black bodies elsewhere are used here. Just the gear of a police officer alone is something like, you know, a couple hundred dollars in a time where we have massive unemployment, massive, you know, economic precarity and all of these types of things. And somehow there's always money for militarization. The masses are coming to this understanding that we must reject how these tools are being used abroad in our name. And so we are in serious solidarity with every human being abroad who's resisting. We see you out there protesting in these embassies, and we love it. We are in complete solidarity with that.
Shyster, let's go to you first this time. We were both been involved in the Stop Trump Coalition, and important to point out in the context of this conversation, one of the things that we always said was that we're not saying that racism only exists in the United States, right? It's precisely say no to Trump, but also shine a light on Trumpism in the UK, right?
Absolutely. And when we first started this movement, we had mainstream journalists kind of laughing and mocking us, asking us, do you really trying to compare what's happening in the UK to what's happening in the US? Are you really trying to compare the policies of Donald Trump's administration with the government in this country? And when we drew those parallels, we were mocked. But actually, that mocking has kind of calmed down quite significantly, I feel. I can see it. You know, when we draw these parallels, when we connect the dots, that's when things become political. To not connect the dots, to not draw the parallels, is to whitewash and depoliticize this violence. You know, here in the UK, we have similar rhetoric as Trump coming from the Prime Minister of this country. So Donald Trump decided to call protesters thugs. This exact same language is being used here. Today, the Prime Minister of this country has come out to say to remove statues is to lie and deny the truth. I mean, it's quite an extraordinary kind of choice of words, deliberate choice of words that have been taken here. Ndindi, when you're talking about these waves and this kind of technology that's being wielded against the people, this reminds me of Guantanamo Bay. You know, the way this type of technology was used against the black and brown Muslim bodies, male bodies, you know, who've been tortured in ways that we've never heard of before. So you're right, absolutely right, to make these connections. And I think more importantly, the people of the world are starting to make these connections. It's impossible to administer white supremacy and to be part of white supremacy you can only do that if you dehumanize everyone, right? But you can only dehumanize everyone if you dehumanize yourself. And what I've found really extraordinary is in the last 72 hours, I've had so many people contact me. And given the context in the UK is that nobody wants to talk about race, okay? It's an issue that nobody ever wants to touch, along with class. These are the two elephants in the room. You never talk about class and you never talk about race. There's a forced conversation now. It's being forced on people. Race and class is the conversation everyone is being forced to have, right? And what I've noticed is this like mass panic that's ensuing and it's gathering momentum, right? And alongside the panic, the people who have been reading history and have been watching and have been paying attention, okay, we're getting more organized. We're getting our act together and it's long overdue. But one thing I will say, my final point, just like you're saying that it's very likely that Trump will end up in the White House, I think we have to be very realistic about this. Primarily, it's because the other side have not got their act together. And just like here in the UK, I feel that the left has been indulging in toxic, reductive identity politics in the same way the right has. But what we're seeing now is a people-led movement which is focused on liberation politics, not identity politics. And that's why this is exciting. That's why this is real. That's why this is dangerous. And that's why this is a very significant moment in history. And as long as we keep functioning with liberation politics, I believe that we can move this movement forward in more dramatic and quicker ways than even we possibly are daring to imagine.
Quincy, I suspect you agree with that.
Definitely. I think the ways in which we in Europe look at Trump is a way of divorcing ourselves from what's happening, as if Trump and the lineage that he comes from wasn't imported from Europe, right? As if colonial violence, fascism wasn't something that was imported and taught up on these shores on the other side of the Atlantic. And I mean, even in terms of thinking of when European leaders supposedly stand up to Trump, as Prime Minister Rutte did a couple of years ago, while during a photo op, he said no. When Trump was saying, like, if the negotiations between the US and the EU didn't come out okay, it would still be positive. And he interrupted him and he said, like, no. But it was just a Dutchman being rude and everyone else saw it as if he was standing up. And I was like, no, this is what they do to everybody. It's not just because he's Trump. And so the connections made with the ways in which Europe tries to disassociate itself from what it has exported to the rest of the world is troubling, because Trump is, not just because he's a third-generation German immigrant, but because he simply is espousing an ideology which was taught up here, which is white superiority, which is white domination, which is a settler colonial look on everything, which is about resource theft, which is about small government, and yet at the same time using the government to fund your own pockets. I mean, what was the scandal that came out where the Secret Service was paying millions and millions and millions for use of his hotel because they had to rent out rooms or stuff? Or even the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars that were paid for the rental of golf caddies. You're like, what? Like, how is that? Was that not just simple plunder of the public system for private profit? And I think that's something that we learn from here in Europe. We see that with all of our different politicians, center right, who are trying to present themselves as if they're not right wing while they're espousing the same type of fascist policies, the same type of colonial policies, just with a nicer smile or something, or with a personality.
And the fact that he went marching to the church, shaking the Bible in his hand, the only thing that was missing was a burning of crosses and the hooded Klansmen, right?
Exactly.
And, you know, having spent, you know, the past nearly 20 years, in particular, US administrations have been painting the Muslims as the fanatics and the extremists. I mean, you simply couldn't make this stuff up. It's so deeply, deeply offensive, but also it's so violent and so it just matches with all the horrors of history, and
exactly.
That imagery is so deliberate, and you know it actually is getting a lot of those white supremacists excited to see this man in power. It's horrific.
Yeah, and I think what's happening now, which I find disturbing as well in terms of the discourse, is that in a certain sense it's been leading to a rehabilitation of George W. Bush, where people are like, okay, Bush was better. And you're like, wait, the uprising of the evangelical right happened under Bush. These are the people who pushed Trump into the White House. How was he better? The 250,000 dead in Iraq and Afghanistan would not agree with you. And in that sense as well, Obama wasn't that much better either in terms of the drone program, in terms of not closing Guantanamo Bay, in terms of not fighting for Black lives. But always what is centered in these conversations is the perpetrator's feelings, right? So it's about the white dominant group within these contexts who need to be felt comfortable for what they're doing and not to be held to account for the damage and the trauma that they're inflicting on everyone else. So no, Trump is more crass, he's more crude, but he's exactly continuing on the policies and the practices of previous administrations. And I think that's something that everyone needs to get to grips with, because the whole system needs to go. It needs to be about a complete defunding of the U.S. and needs to be about an understanding of what exactly does it mean to be part of the United States. It means the Trail of Tears. It means the bombing of MOVE in Philadelphia in 1985. It means the continued incarceration of people from the Black Panthers. It means the killing of Fred Hampton in Chicago as he's trying to create this rainbow coalition to fight white supremacy. This is the U.S. This guy has been locking up kids. There are concentration camps with kids in the U.S. That should have been the moment when all of these people rose up and was like, no, this is done. And I think that again comes to the understanding of, like, how do we make sure that all of these different fights are connected to one another, and that it doesn't need to be the other side of a dead body or trauma to push us to that point of actually pushing for it. I mean, he was in a bunker. Trump was in a bunker for an hour and a half because they thought that the White House would be overrun. I was like, wow, that's amazing. Imagine if that would have happened.
We've touched on it quite a lot already, but one of the themes of the discussion right up till now has been this representation between real world violence and the cultural representations of real world violence, right? So you saw that quite remarkable moment, Shyster, in Bristol, where the Edward Colston statue was brought down. That's quite a moment in a British radical history. It sparked a huge debate in the UK, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. And I think we can also substitute the word debate for hysteria, Luke.
In some quarters.
Yeah, in some quarters. You know, this whole thing about where will this end? It's like, we haven't even started. What are you talking about? But yes, that was a profound and very moving and powerful moment. No one can deny that. And the fact that it happened spontaneously as well, I think says a lot. And the fact, again, that it was a group of a very, you know, lots of different people, white people, black people, all people joining in. And the fact they threw it into the river as well is deeply, you know, symbolic. And it has absolutely triggered this national conversation and hysteria as well and panic, but also thoughtfulness, you know, thoughtful conversation about what is going on here. Why are these symbols dotted around this country? Why have they been there for hundreds and hundreds of years? And why is it so offensive to some people to see this reaction? And, you know, there's a constant kind of like attempt to frame the reaction as being violent. It's like, well, what about the violence of slavery? And what about the violence of all the systems that slavery has then endorsed? And that, you know, what about that violence? So, you know, I did a media interview this week where somebody, a very prominent journalist, was saying to me, you know, what about the forefathers? Do you think that people should have to constantly apologize for their forefathers? And I said, but what about the forefathers of black men and women who don't even know the names of their forefathers? What about them? Like, do you think about them? And for a moment, this guy just stopped. He kind of just took a pause. And he said, I could tell that you hadn't thought about it, right? So I think part of this is, for me, is about being able to be compassionate and human, okay, towards those who deny compassion and humanness and humanity to us. It's easy for me to say that because I'm not a black man or a woman, just to be very clear, I'm a woman of color, okay? But I feel that the bottom line is, the reason why there is this much anxiety is because I feel like if this is as good as it gets for white people who believe in white supremacy, that they believe that their granular humanity is attached to a statue, that's quite devastating, right? I find that really devastating because I'm like, that's really very tragic. And we have to break that down and we have to understand it. So I feel like right now there's a lot of triggers for people, okay? These statues are a trigger because these statues represent something much more than statues. So then at the same time, these commentators deny, they're just like, oh, this is just a statue. You guys need to chill out. It's like, well, if this is just a statue, why are you reacting to this in the way that you are?
Another side of this has of course been blackface. In Britain, we've seen a real turn in popular culture on this. I think shows like Little Britain, Mighty Boosh, both being withdrawn from streaming services. Quincy, could you tell us about the long-standing work you've done on this in the movement against Wati Pete? I understand, and I don't know much about it, so please tell us about it and the listeners. There's been some movement on this question recently in the Netherlands too. Minds are changing, people are rethinking. I think Prime Minister Mark Rutte like came out and said that he's changed his position, which, you know, any listeners that know who Mark Rutte is, he's very, very centrist dad. Center-right centrist dads. So, and you might even, in evidence perhaps, that centrists are not as liberal sometimes as they think they are, right?
Like connecting to this notion of monuments and traditions and identities and identifications with these symbols. One of the things I was talking online today with some friends about was this notion of humiliation. And that these monuments are trophies for humiliation, and they're part of a way to think about social hierarchy, racial hierarchy, and being anchored in place, visible in place, so that we know who's on top. Literally talking about who do we put on the pedestal and who needs to look up from below, right? And so in regards to the way in which like this Zwarte Piet tradition and practice has now been shifted and shaken, it's a blackface tradition. For 3 weeks in October, November, people in the Netherlands black up. And it's not just a question of one or two people. It's like parades with 700 of them. It's like images in stores. It's folders. It's flyers. It's TV shows. It's movies. It's CDs. It's concerts. It's events. It's just, you can't believe it. Because a lot of people think about the Netherlands as progressive. And they think about the red light district. They think about weed. They think about euthanasia. While not really seeing all those things as exactly in line with blackface. Because blackface and the way in which it's practiced in the Netherlands is connected to a veneration of a colonial past. So it's connected to an upholding of this racial order and also thinking about who is productive. And not just who is productive, but also who is productive as the guest the guest who comes for 3 weeks and then leaves. And so when you have black and brown bodies, black and North African bodies, black and migrant bodies, black and refugee bodies in the Netherlands trying to deal and discuss this, you're constantly being told that you're a guest that also needs to leave. And so the symbol is part of that mechanism of always othering you. And so this week, after years of denying that the figure was an issue, even at the International Nuclear Conference, when he was asked about it by a journalist, saying that, you know, Black Pete is black, I can't do anything about it, or even joking that he has Dutch Caribbean friends who don't need to paint their faces black to play the figure. And you're like, what? And so today, no, it was, I think, yesterday, he said that after seeing the massive protests here in the Netherlands since the 1st of June, that now he understands why Black Pete is offensive and why some people would be hurt by it. And then he said this, and the next day, he kind of took it back, because then he said, like, it's not racist. And he said as well that he doesn't know any policies to change it. He doesn't want to meddle with it because it's a cultural issue. Right? And I think this is the classic liberal position, as the way how we understand liberalism here in the Netherlands, is this disconnect from that their policies are already imposing restrictions on people's lives and saying that they cannot impose restrictions on people's lives. They're for freedom, freedom of everything, and so they will not impose restrictions. While the freedom of movement is imposed on refugees, during the coronavirus pandemic, they even shut down the offices where refugees could go and say, like, hey, we're in the country, help us. They shut those down because they were like, people could be coming in with the virus and they didn't know. All this type of nonsense. It's this thing of racial order, right? And these monuments are testaments of racial order. And so taking them down is not a question of erasing history. It's about balancing out what should have, what has been in disbalance since colonialism started, since Columbus got his decree from the Queen and King of Spain to cross the ocean, right? This is the imbalance that these monuments are still trying to uphold and that we need to take down.
Yeah, when I was getting prepped for this interview, he asked, like, so how do you feel about some of the issues and criticisms like editing history? It's like, what do you say to this? Editing history? It's anything. It's a challenge to propaganda about history, which you could say is editing history.
Exactly.
Yeah. Dindi, this has been a longstanding issue in the US in many ways, on lots of, you mentioned statues earlier, but also things like the Confederate flag and stuff, right, as well.
I'm really thankful to be here with Quincy and Shaista, because I really get to understand what's going on in your own context and how connected our struggles are. Here, what the reason the Confederacy has survived, again, this is a war that was lost, and it was a war about owning people. Owning Black people. And can you imagine losing a war, losing the right to own people and holding on to it? This type of investment in white supremacy is absurd, and we should point it out every time. I see people trying to have nuanced debates, and I think this is quite frankly why the liberal order is crumbling, because they do not have a good response to what's going on here. So the folks who love the Confederacy, they talk about heritage and tradition and family. And we are also wondering about our own heritage and our own traditions and our own family. And we don't, again, kind of what Quincy said, the looking up at is highly problematic. What I also should say about these struggles, same thing with Black Lives Matter, where you did have people really start out quite politely asking for, please just put a plaque. This is absurd that the slave owner is in the middle of our campus, you know. To let's remove it and put it in a museum, to now we're just about to throw them in the river. This is where we are because people have been pushed so far. The most hilarious image I saw most recently was Google updated its map, and now Columbus, there's a dot in the, like, an actual river of where, you know, this whole statue has been toppled. It's fantastic. We love it. We love to struggle, but we're going to rejoice in these moments. And I also wanted to say, I think Shaista pointed to this. Now this forced conversation on race is not just pushing kind of the right or those who are openly antagonistic. This is a moment where the good white people are kind of finding a reckoning. So the liberals and the progressives who don't think they have racist bones in their body are now being forced to reckon with some of these things. And in many ways, they don't know what to do. We're seeing them showing up, kneeling, releasing statements, this, that, and the other. And what we're saying is, don't kneel with us. Get up and struggle with us. Get into some anti-racist praxis, you know, stop pandering. So that's really interesting as well, when you put these symbols forward and you just think that we will receive you because you somehow have some kind of anti-racist statement. And we're saying this does not go far enough, because look at the cities we live in. Look at our communities. This isn't what it is. And I think also on that point of identity politics, I'm really glad that Shaista brought up the limitations of just representational or electoral politics. They don't necessarily go far enough. So the whole, we're going to hire more black people and more brown people, really doesn't do it. I completely agree with, we want liberation politics. And we have a structural analysis of why racism, imperialism, colonialism, all of these things exist. And in fact, people of color can uphold these systems as well. So not just anybody will do, you know, not just anyone will do. And so that's been important too, that identity politics in themselves are not going to save us.
Absolutely. And as a woman of color, I know very clearly how we people of color uphold anti-blackness, perpetuate it daily, deny it, you know, leech off black culture, and then still have the audacity to deny the agency of black people in this specific moment, in this specific movement building. I see it daily. It's absolutely disgraceful, and it's been called out, right? And I think that the job that each of us have, including everybody's listening to this, is we have to make sure that we do not allow this movement to be derailed by the so-called good folks, right? The good black people, the good brown people, the good trans people, the good white people, because it's just total crap, right? So unless we sign up and totally the issue of liberation politics into our DNA, into our movement, we won't be able to win. None of us will ever win. And I think that this is a frightening prospect for those who have also built their careers on the back of black people. I'm talking about people of color here as well, okay? We need to call those people out as well.
Coronavirus, this has all been taking place at this extraordinary moment, this global pandemic, massive amounts of suffering out there. I mean, particularly in Britain and the United States, just because their public health systems, the context and the way in which the virus has hit them and so on. But all over the world, it's affected everyone. Particularly BAME communities have been affected. I noticed that one in five deaths in the United States have been African Americans. And that's staggering disproportion. The community is about 12% of Americans, for listeners. And there's a lot of other similar data out there on this issue and lots of discussion.
Yeah, it's violence. It's the violence of the state, violence of the systems, the ongoing relentless violence against black people and people of colour. That's what it is. This has not happened by accident. You know, this has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. You know, there's so much documented evidence about how health professionals have treated and exploited black people's bodies, particularly black women's bodies, over so many hundreds of years, right? And the denial of dignity to our people, this kind of false belief that, you know, we're just indestructible and all the rest of it. And it's just devastating. And I think, again, you know, I'll just sort of link this point to class again, because, you know, your class can't save you. Coronavirus is not going to save you. It doesn't matter how much money you've got, which university you went to, what an eminent professor or a doctor you are. Here in the UK, we've seen a massive number of medical professionals, majority of them are people of colour, okay? A lot of them are migrants who came to this country to build this country, to serve the NHS, dying, dropping dead like flies. It's absolutely devastating. At the same time, we're seeing Filipino porters, right? And others, you know, who are earning pennies, okay? Who are not being given the protective equipment to do their jobs. They're dying at the same time. So you've got these eminent consultants, you know, very, very highly educated individuals dying from the same horrific disease as those who are being paid a pittance. And I think the the whole thing about, you know, lots of commentators have said this, right? But this whole thing about I can't breathe, you know, the synergy with the coronavirus and I can't, literally can't breathe and I'm dying. And then I can't breathe, the violence, the brutality of the police and the white supremacist system. You couldn't write this. You really couldn't. And there's a deep connection and people are feeling it. And, you know, the fact that this is going on and it's been denied for so long, the inequalities, the injustice, it's impossible to ignore anymore. And it can't be ignored. And I do believe this is a moment of reckoning. And we have to make sure that there are answers and the answers are long term and there is change.
In the US, I suppose one thing people looking at it watching, I mean, it must have crossed your mind, the pandemic risk in a lot of these places. I was looking at some of the data, Los Angeles, like New York, places that have seen really big protests. How has that been discussed in the US in the protest movement, protecting people from the virus in the context of challenging the state?
Thank you. This is a great question. I think what we have in the US, and I can't really speak to other places, but I think authoritarianism and fascism comes with also an anti-intellectualism. And so here, the right wing, you have people who don't believe the virus is real, who have fought and think that their personal freedoms are being taken away because of that. So we have that going on here where people are fighting masks and protective gear and all of these types of things, predominantly white people. If you saw those protests, there was not a face of color there because we are actually out here dying in real life. So, and we see it, and that goes across, that cuts across all strata here in the US, you know, working class black people, wealthy black, brown people across, we completely understand. Also, when we look at the phenomenon that is kind of Trump or this authoritarianism thing, I always love to remind everybody, black women, only like 3%, black people, only 3% hailed in this age of Trump. And yet we are the people suffering the most from it. So at the protests, what we've been thinking and talking a lot about is we are dying anyway. And we are compelled. We have no choice but to be in these streets. We have no choice. It is a matter of justice. It is a matter of life or death. And we are also out here fighting that medical racism that Shaista alluded to. We're out here protecting ourselves. There, I finally have found supplies, like I've been telling people. I haven't had supplies. I found them on the street with people who are passing them out, passing out information, fighting their elected officials to do something about this. We're also asking children to really not participate because, again, like you see, there's violence out here. People with health conditions, all of those people, we're asking them to join our struggle in a different way. So we are very conscious about this, but we are declaring, you know, we're dying. So we must do this. We must be out here. We must be out here as safely as we can be. I think the reason we haven't seen that pushback from the right wing is for all of those reasons I said before. Because they fundamentally don't care if we do die. This is the truth of the matter. Like these politics of disposability, they fundamentally do not care if we die. And this is why they're not really questioning why we're out here. They question when we fight back. They don't mind when we're brutalized. And they don't mind that the coronavirus is killing us. And I will end with a senator yesterday, Huffman, who actually is an ER doctor who said, well, the reason that, you know, people of color are dying in this way from this virus is because the coloreds don't wash their hands. This was his analysis as an ER doctor and a senator. This is the kind of violent language that we all have to contend with here all the time. And the pushback on every level, like just the intellectual pushback, the actual physical in the streets, every which way. But again, like I said, we're out here because we're compelled to. We must, and we are going to be free. There is no other way.
And I think that also then connects in the way in which the Netherlands also looks at these protests, and people are also standing out in solidarity and trying to make sure they keep the corona distance, so the 1.5 meter society, as we have started to call it. But the right wing has been using these protests in a way as well to criticize left wing politicians. So the mayor in Amsterdam was almost toppled because she led the demonstration, which was supposed to only beach for 250 to 300 people, but ended up actually attracting around 8,000 to 10,000 people. And no one was expecting it, not even the police. And then everyone started shouting about, like, oh, wait, are they really keeping distance? Is this really safe? So it became a matter of social health, societal health, instead of actually talking about racism. So everything that was supposed to be talking about police violence and what are we going to do with and systemic racism flipped on its head. And then while that was flipping, other people were also like, hey, we need to talk about racism because, you know, 10,000 people showed up. So what are we going to do? And then you see all of these PR type of interviews with politicians who are trying to profit off of the moment and thinking like, hey, this will lead to more votes because next year, March, we have elections. So all these different things are coming together and you're like, wait, let's go back to why we're out here and what we're actually talking about. Systemic change and understanding the ways in which the colonial past is actually still the colonial present. We have not moved on. These statues, these protests, everything is part of that same type of logic and that same type of disbalance of society as we have it. But I want to thank you all because this was amazing.
Thank you so much.
It's a real pleasure to meet you both. I'm in awe of the work that you're both doing. And yeah, we've just got to keep building, right?
Definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you. This is really great to meet all of you and engage with you. I've been really enjoying the international solidarity and also being seen. You know, there's only 12% of people who are Black in this nation, and that we've been able to have an uprising.
That concludes this special edition of the Another Europe podcast. This was produced as part of a collaboration with the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung. For more information on their work on building progressive dialogues between Germany and Britain, go to fes-london.org. There is no extra time this week. Members of Another Europe generally get access to extra podcast content as a benefit of supporting the campaign. We didn't feel that was appropriate for this episode, so it's all free to air. We would, of course, still encourage you to join and support our work. To do so, go to anotheureurope.org/join. There are lots of ways that we can all help to push this moment in history in the right direction. So please do whatever you can to support the Black Lives Matter movement. That might mean making a financial contribution or posting support for the movement online. There are lots of support funds out there, but one to consider if you'd like to make a financial contribution is the UK Black Lives Matter Support Fund, which is closing in on a remarkable £1 million. You really see how many people have been touched by this moment. You can find that one by going to www.gofundme.com/F/UKBLM-fund. It's not the easiest URL, but you could also just find it on Google if you Google UK Black Lives Matter GoFundMe. Thanks for listening. Take care and support each other. We'll be back very soon. See you then.